Support for this episode of the podcast comes from our patrons at Patreon. Head to patreon.com/chasingearhart to join the chase and become a patron today. Chasing Earhart, the discussion panel, is taking place in just over 2 months on Saturday, July 21st, 2018 in Atchison, Kansas, during the 22nd annual Amelia Earhart Festival. Go to chasingearhart.rsvpify.com. That's chasingearhart.rsvpify.com to reserve your seats for this historic panel event. On the morning of July 2nd, 1937, Amelia Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. Going on 81 years later, all over the world, lie scattered pieces of their puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to the Chasing Earhart Podcast.
I took off the famous Harbor Grace runway at dusk, about 7:30, I believe. I flew for a couple of hours while sunset lasted, and then two more hours as the moon came up over a bank of clouds. I had fair weather for 4 hours. Then I ran into a storm, which was one of the most severe I have ever been in. I milled around in the storm here for probably an hour, and with difficulty kept my course. I had been troubled with my exhaust manifold burning through all night. A weld broke shortly after I left Harbor Grace, and I could see the damage increasing as the night wore on. I found specific thunderstorms probably 300 or 400 miles off the coast of Ireland. I believe I saw land first about the middle. I decided to come down anyway in the best available pasture. I got down without any trouble and taxied to the front door of a surprised farmer's cottage. After receiving a real Irish welcome, I took a Paramount plane to London, and there received a real English welcome.
After finding a previously unknown 1932 film of Amelia Earhart at Harbor Grace, Newfoundland, project guest Bill Zook began a long odyssey across Canada, which has took him to the places in Canada where Amelia had visited or lived. From serving in the First World War as a nurse's assistant in Toronto, to using Newfoundland as the jumping-off point on her two transatlantic flights, over 7 other instances of Amelia's visits to Canada have been identified, including a tuna fishing expedition in 1934 with her sister Muriel. On July 2, 1937, imagine the world's most famous woman setting out on a groundbreaking circumnavigation of the globe and suddenly disappearing. Amelia Earhart and her navigator were lost over the South Pacific, yet today, over 80 years later, the search for Amelia Earhart continues, with historians and researchers trying to probe the mysteries of this fascinating icon. Tonight, on the 44th episode of the Chasing Earhart podcast, learn about her early life, the many connections to Canada, and why Amelia's star has never faded, in a conversation with Bill Zook, historian, author, and filmmaker. Well, this is an interview that is going to carry with it a lot of unknown information regarding Amelia Earhart. Joining us from Canada via Zoom is Bill Zook. He is a Canadian aviation historian, and he is going to share with us a lot of interesting information that ties Amelia Earhart to Canada. Bill, thank you for sitting in on the podcast tonight.
Thank you.
Now, Bill, let's get a little housekeeping done first, if for no other reason than to get it out of the way so we can get into what we're here to discuss tonight. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about your education and your professional background?
Originally, I began as a teacher librarian, and for 33 years, that was my field of interest as well. And in 1999, I had a heart operation and decided that was going to make a wholesale change in my life entirely. And so I decided to go into becoming an author and a filmmaker and kind of working with some of the interests that I had in the past. I came up as an air cadet originally, got my flying license through that, was intending to go all the way into the Air Force until my eyesight stopped that or prevented that from happening. But it was always an interest of mine. So the first things that I started working on, in fact, turned out to be books on aviation history in Canada. So my work there had also moved into the area of filmmaking. And a number of the books that I had written actually had become the basis of films, Discovery Channel, Space History Channel films, documentary films that continue on even to now. Recently, I have become an associate historian for the Royal Canadian Air Force, and that sort of is a focused in area of expertise that has allowed me to kind of work in this area. We've just been in the whole statue-making project of creating some statues to honor aviation heroes in our country. And I've just finished two of them with a sculptor.
Now, you have quite the background in aviation history, but I want to ask about the Canadian Aviation Historical Society. Can you first tell everyone what that is and also explain how you became involved in that organization?
Well, over 30 years ago, even when I was working as a librarian, I had started to become involved in different organizations. And the Canadian Aviation Historical Society, it's about 600 to 700, 800 members across Canada of historians that concentrate on that topic, our heritage in aviation in Canada. They are an organization that puts out a professional journal. They also have in the past done some publishing of books that their members have been a part of. Lately, we've also started to look at other aspects, and one of them kind of connected to Amelia Earhart. And that was a dedication of a former airport site in New Brunswick. And from that point on, that just sort of connected with me again. Amelia Earhart has always been an interest of mine. The story, I think, began just when I happened to be in Atchison, Kansas to see her birthplace museum many, many years ago. And my wife being very interested as well in people that have inclination towards women's rights, and was interested in visiting as well, because at the time the 99s were looking after the museum, and it was a eventful visit. It sort of sparked a lot of things. When I came back home, I joined the Tiger Group. At the time, again, I was still very interested in aviation history as it applied to Canada. His work then had been along the lines of looking at a possible other transatlantic flight that had been made to Canada by Ungassar and Colley. And I was quite interested in that and was working on that area. And all of a sudden, it sort of now verged in terms of Tiger's emphasis to Amelia Earhart.
Now, I know how she came into your life professionally because you and I have talked about it off the air, but do you remember what your earliest recollections are of Amelia Earhart?
Well, as I said, I think even as a child, there are certain aviation icons that come to mind, and she being one of them. And the fact that she was a female aviator made it, you know, doubly important to try to find out more about her. And I was sort of nibbling on the edges at that point, still looking at a lot of different subjects and seeing what would be of interest to kind of pursue further. Looking at, for example, the Cochrane story. And as Amelia's friend, that kind of story that was in her her two biographical books came across as being very, very unique. Now, for a little while, I was involved in a contract with an aviation museum for about 2 years, working here in Winnipeg with at the time, the aviation museum that was called today it's called the Royal Aviation Museum of Western Canada, then the Western Canada Aviation Museum. We received a film in, I guess, about 1997 that was simply just put away. The archivist took a quick look at what was, in fact, just a VHS tape copy of a film, and it didn't go any farther than that until a change in personnel occurred. And I was passed a film that I took a look at, and it had a 5-minute clip of Amelia Earhart in Newfoundland. And that alone was the basis of a kind of an odyssey across Canada. I was fascinated by the pictures because I'd never seen the images that were on this film. I was fairly sure that I knew where the film originated. And from that point on, it started me on a trek across a number of different locations in Canada where Amelia had once been. And it started with Toronto, where my son lived at that time, to find out that she had been a nurse's assistant in Toronto, finding the original location, started me off on all the other spots that had been mentioned either in her diaries, her books, other people's work on Amelia, until probably over a 5 to 10 year span, I've now kind of touched base with everything that she's sort of been a part of in Canada.
And for the first time in the history of this podcast, we will release a video version of this episode on our YouTube page that will show this video as we're discussing it. And of course, for the sake of our subscribers out there that are listening to this conversation, directly below this clip, they'll have the video below them so they can watch it as well. But before we get further into the video, a little exposition for everyone listening out there. This video was brought to our attention because you were on our website, chasingearhart.com, several months ago, and you felt compelled to reach out to me and inform me that you had this video in your possession, and you told me then over the phone the story on how you came to receive it. And you were then kind enough to send me this video. It's quite an extraordinary piece, and I wonder if you wouldn't mind taking our listeners through the clip as they watch it here and explain to everyone what's going on and give everyone a little history lesson in regards to what they're seeing.
Well, one thing is it's unique in that it hadn't been shown before. It looked like it had been a homemade film. And it was in two segments, and the first being about a 30-second clip of another aircraft coming into what was a water landing and a harbor. And the aircraft was easily identifiable as the Dornier DO X, which had flown to Canada in 1932. That alone, probably anybody watching the film originally and hadn't gone any farther than the 30 seconds would have missed the rest of the film, which was the 5-minute composite of a number of scenes of Amelia Earhart in Harbor Grace, Newfoundland. At the time, Harbor Grace was one of the destination spots for flyers that wanted to do the what they called the big hop across the Atlantic. It was the nearest airport location that would, or the farthest out to sea that would give them a chance to get across the Atlantic with the fuel loads that were used in those days. So that film alone, and we tried as best as we could to try to find its location. It came without any markings or information about who had made the film. Eventually, tracing it to Newfoundland at least gave us a starting point. And going to Newfoundland to its capital city, St. John's, Newfoundland, and Memorial College, where there is a large archive, by chance, the curator and librarian there recognized the film when I brought her a copy. So I traveled to Newfoundland, then found out, at least in their records, they had a name. They had a name of a family, the Baird family, a fairly well-known family in that city. And at least we knew who Douglas Baird was. And Douglas was the actual donor of this film. What we also found out is the film had been sent to other locations right across the country, to other air museums, and no one had actually taken the time to look at it except for our museum. Once that had taken place, we wanted to share it. We knew that it had been given without any copyright restrictions, but the film hadn't been seen anywhere before. PBS had wanted to use a segment of the film. We also knew that the Smithsonian had a real interest in this film or the story of Amelia Earhart. So I made some copies dubbed down into DVD format and started to send them around. And the Smithsonian eventually received a copy of it as well through our museum. The other thing that happened was that traveling to Newfoundland, at first I had no idea other than Harbor Grace being pretty important to the story of Amelia Earhart. I knew that part was easy to identify, but where did the Dornier come from? And that original story started me on a trek through all of Newfoundland, going to locations that were in one time or another connected to aviation. So eventually it ended up that I went to where Amelia had come to Newfoundland in 1928, to Trapezi. And then just by absolute happenstance, we traveled through a whole series of small towns and villages and hamlets to try to find where the Dornier came in. It had to be at a harbor. It had to be in a place where there was a kind of a landscape behind that would match the film. And eventually we found the place. There in this little tiny town was a museum, kind of a community museum. When I approached them with the film, we could actually match up just by looking outside the windows of the museum, the exact location of where the Dornier was. So we now knew that that was taken at the same time by the same person, likely. So 1932 and Newfoundland, and that gave us a really good, you know, idea of what this story was going to be all about. Now, it's not the only time that she came to Canada. Amelia has a real connection with Canada. And that alone gave me pause and made me think of why she was so tied to our aviation history as well as hers.
And that is a great segue into what we'll ultimately be discussing tonight, and that's Amelia's very interesting history and connection to Canada. I have a handful of questions to ask you regarding that connection, but let's start with Amelia and her sister Muriel. Let's begin by having you tell us what brought them to Toronto, Canada in the first place.
At the time, you know, where Amelia was 19 and her sister Muriel was 2 years younger, both were at a point where they were looking for a preparatory school that would help them get into college. And preparatory schools were a lot more common in those days. Muriel wanted to become a teacher. And the school that she chose, in fact, was in Toronto. Her mom was financing most of both Amelia and Muriel's schooling. And coming to Toronto for her meant St. Mary's College in downtown Toronto. That preparatory school would allow her to move towards a normal school, which would have been a teacher's college in those days, and become a teacher, which is what her interest was leading her to. Amelia was a little bit more unsure of where her life was going. She called it paths, and she wasn't sure which path her life should take. She had actually signed up as a pre-med student with Ugnet School in Philadelphia, and that was a part of what was happening in 1916. She was 19, deciding on a career. Her parents both thought that she had a lot of potential to be anything she wanted. And choosing to be a doctor was certainly one of those areas that she had some interest at that time. She chose a very heavy course load in the preparatory school and became very, very active. She was a little bit older than most of the other students at 19. Most of them were 16 and 17 years of age, entering into basically junior college ranks. She was elected the vice president of the school in her class. She also ended up being the secretary and secretary treasurer of the Red Cross chapter of the American Red Cross at the school. Ended up also taking part in a religious group called the Young People's Society of Christian Endeavor. So she had become very, very active there. The kids knew her by her familiar sort of nickname. As a youngster, she was Millie or Mealy in the places where she lived. There she was Butterball. And that was a real kind of an inside joke because, or Butter, they sometimes called her Butter, she said in her diary. And letters back home to her mother, because it was the complete opposite of what she was. She was lean and muscular and very sports-like. She was 5 foot eight, tall for her age and tall for that time period. The only one taller in the whole school was the headmistress who ran and managed the school. And at that point, she was exploring a lot of different things. In that path that she wanted to choose, she started collecting a series of newspaper and magazine clippings of what she called activities of women. Those women were the ones that were achieving things that were almost unheard of at the time. One was a film producer, another was a police commissioner, an ocean liner captain. These were women that she felt, you know, were so free and fascinating lives that they were leading. She probably wanted to do the same thing. Now, in Christmas of 1917, America was at war already, but Canada and other parts of the world had been at war since 1914. With Amelia coming to Toronto to visit Muriel in Christmas, she also saw a country at war. More than many other countries, it was a small nation that almost mobilized the entire group of people that were at home as well as in uniform. So all of a sudden, Amelia was struck by a very powerful sight. Four men in crutches walking down the street. Each of them had lost a leg and they were holding each other up. And she barely could look at them. She quickly looked away and stared into a store window and looked at them again as they walked by. And from that point on, she knew that she had to change. She would do something with her life. She had chosen a new path now. And it wasn't to be a student. It was to be somebody that was going to be active and someone that could actually make a difference.
And that, of course, leads us to a name that I think maybe the casual Amelia Earhart fan, or maybe even the folks that follow the project, may not be familiar with. And that name is Sister Amelia. Can you educate us on how Amelia Earhart became Sister Amelia and what that exactly meant?
Even back at her school, she had already started to become very active with the American Red Cross. And one of the activities that she could undertake would have been to become a nurse herself if she chose. And medical professions in those days, not just a doctor but a nurse, were all in the same kind of area. So she, through her own very meager funds that had been supplied by her mother, the coursework there for each term was quite an expensive $600 at the time. But she took out of that money not only her books and her clothes, but she also ordered a supply of surgical bandages and dressings and a nurse's cap and gown, because she was exploring the idea of maybe becoming a nurse. And when she was in Toronto, she continued that training kind of on her own, because she had to then take some coursework. She continued training at the St. John's Ambulance Brigade in Toronto to learn her first aid that she needed, and then took more courses in home nursing. And because what she was entering is an organization at the time that was made up of civilian nurses and nurses' assistants that would go out to do hospital work and sometimes real war work, which is what she indicated to her mother that she needed to do. She needed to do war work. They could be sent right across into combat zones in Europe, but the group that she was a part of, the Volunteer Aid Detachment, the VADs, in most cases were assigned to hospitals. Sometimes out in the field, but most cases there are civilian hospitals behind the lines. And in the way that the British, and this was originally a British organization, had kind of differentiated between the nurse and the nurse's assistant, was to call the assistants, the VADs, sisters. And so Amelia took on the term Sister Amelia, and that's what all the soldiers in her ward would have called her.
Now, you just mentioned the soldiers in her ward. Who would her patients have been at that time?
She was assigned to originally just a small hospital and was working before with the training that she had before she went to the Spadina Military Convalescent Hospital. It's now in the University of Toronto on Knox College. That was a college then as well that was converted into a military hospital. The soldiers that were returning from battle were returning from battles such as Vimy and Passchendaele. Most of the soldiers had been gassed. They came back with what they called ailments of the chest. And in many cases, there was nothing evident that was the reason why they were there. They were called the shell-shocked soldiers. These were, today, I guess a modern description would have been post-traumatic stress disorder. These were people that could not go back into battle. They may not have lost their nerve, but they certainly weren't able to cope with what they had seen. In many cases, these people had seen their best friends die in front of them. Some of them were badly wounded. Some of them wouldn't have had anything that would have been evident on the outside. Her very first day, a fire broke out in her ward, and the fire alarm that started off sent a lot of these men into pure shock. She wrote down that the poor men in the shell shock ward, most of them have been through a physical and emotional crisis. This is what she was seeing and what she was facing. So the soldiers that she saw were young men, no older than she was in most cases. She had duties that would take them to the outside sometimes. She would be encouraged to have these men come and go into an ordinary life again. Most of them would not return back into uniform. One of the groups that she also looked after was made up of British officers that were in the Royal Flying Corps. And that was probably the most violent and deadly of professions in those days. Pilots had a very, very short lifespan in terms of minutes sometimes in the air. And she had to look after them as well. And these were men that were, in some cases, clamoring to get back into action. They knew that they needed some convalescence, but they wanted to go back to war. The war was now winding down, though. This was 1918 by the time Amelia began her work in the Spadina Hospital.
Now, Bill, you just mentioned some of the duties that she had. Can you talk about what nursing assistants would have done at that time? Amelia had some interesting responsibilities.
Well, unlike the nurses that would look after sort of the serious medical conditions, the nurses' assistants had a lot of different tasks that were put in front of them. They started their day at 7 o'clock and ended in the evening at 7 o'clock in the evening. And it was an ongoing cleaning of the ward and administering medication. She said ladling the medication out of a bucket. It seemed like that. She would be scrubbing floors. She'd be looking after the food that was served at the meals. And in fact, that sort of led her to work in the kitchen. She found that the men told her what they were seeing. It was a dull, monotonous day, strapped almost to a bed, and the food made it no better. And she looked at the food, and knowing that as part of her duties in the dietary kitchen, she could change some of that. So she researched really quickly some of the choices that could be made out there, and some of the decisions she made was to go to a local store and buy some canned tomatoes. And that changed some of the ways that the men saw their food being given out. They often got the same thing day after day after day. And that became part of the tedium in effect. Rice pudding was served as a dessert. One of the soldiers, when he saw it for the umpteenth time, buried his spoon inside there and made it like a little cross and gave it back to Amelia. She used her winnings from matching pennies. This was a little game that the nurses and the nurses' assistants played in the kitchen. They would flick pennies, and the ones that could match them could keep those pennies. And she took her winnings and bought ice cream for the men instead. So she was, in a lot of ways, trying to make the most of what these men were facing. And that was a very hard life, it seemed, even in the hospital. That didn't preclude her from also seeking out some interesting things to do, not only in the kitchen, but she started to work in the dispensary. And she had some background from school in chemistry, and that alone was the reason why she was reassigned to jobs like that. So she would do some culture swabs and get some slides made. And but not only that, she was in charge of some of the medicinal whiskey, and as a teetotaler, they were quite sure that she wouldn't be imbibing. So that was another reason why she had that job. But it also gave her the chance to explore what she thought might still be her career, and that's a career in medicine.
Let's switch gears a bit and cover something else that I think a lot of our listeners may not know about, and that is the fact that Amelia rode horses. In your writings, you talk about a horse named Dynamite. Now, Dynamite was one of the horses that Amelia would rent from a local stable from time to time. Can you educate everyone on Dynamite and the role that horse riding played in Amelia's life?
With some spare time available, and it wasn't a lot, but during the weekends and when it matched Muriel's schedule, Amelia had the chance to take in hockey games. She loved ice hockey and saw it maybe for the first time in Toronto. She played tennis. She played tennis on a really competitive level. People thought of her almost as a professional. But she also was a rider, and a very gifted rider, along with Muriel. Both girls had stable horses that they had a chance to ride in their grandmother's farm. And from the age of about 8 or 9, they were very gifted riders. And Dynamite, at the stable that both Muriel and Amelia chose, was the one horse no one could ride. It was a mean, black, huge stead that was really out of bounds. It was off limits to anybody. But Amelia chose that as her project, and using some sugar cubes and some apples and some gentle caressing and actually a firm hand on the reins, she managed to tame Dynamite, which no one thought was possible. The stable owner gave her the chance to ride Dynamite anytime she chose. And people began to notice that, that Dynamite was actually out in the field and about. And one of those people was a captain in one of the wards that she had actually looked after. And he invited her to ride Dynamite, and along with Muriel, to come over to where the training was taking place, where the pilots were still flying. And there was a number of different airfields all around Toronto, but Armour Heights was nearby, and that's where he trained.
It's been argued by me that Amelia was America's sweetheart. But what's interesting about Amelia is that Toronto, as you've been discussing in this conversation, held a very special place in Amelia's heart, especially when it comes to aviation. Can you tell everyone why that's true and where Amelia first became interested in aviation?
At Armour Heights, she had a chance to get up close. She had a chance to talk to the pilots. She just loved the whole idea of the romance that was behind these men, because they talked all the time about their adventures, their exploits, their fibs. But to be honest, she saw the world of aviation as being exciting and one that she wanted to be a part of. She tried to coax her way into actually going on board a flight, and they just wouldn't allow it. No civilian was allowed, and even if it was the general's wife, they said they just couldn't do that. They would be in trouble if they did. But instead, she came back time after time after time to Armour Heights and listened to their stories and heard as much as she could and took in as much as she could about the mechanics of flying as well. And at the armistice on November the 11th in 1918, Canada was celebrating the end of the war, and at the Canadian National Exhibition Grounds, where In fact, it had been a training ground and had been turned into a wartime base. They staged an airfare, well, an air show. And Amelia took one of her friends from the hospital to the show because she wanted to see the airplanes flying. What she had seen at Armour Heights, often she got close enough to get the wind from the propellers and the snow in her face, but she didn't have a chance to see them in the air. And at the airfare, they took a spot somewhere far from the rest of the crowd in a clearing where they could see the aircraft above them, because that's where they were staging. But one pilot spotted them right off and saw that they were by themselves and thought maybe being bored, he would give them a thrill, and he decided to fly and kind of do a dive bombing of these two girls in the field. Well, her friend took off, but Amelia stood her ground, and she said, you know, it was a thrill. It was something that she thought that little red airplane spoke to her and said something. So even though she's an American icon, Toronto lays claim to a part of her life, and that is that it sparked that love of aviation in her that she would continue on to have for years after.
Certainly. Now, we've talked about her nursing assistant career in Canada during this show, but Amelia actually became a patient herself at one point. Can you talk about why Amelia was admitted?
1918 was a really chaotic time across the world. The Spanish flu, the influenza was taking place, and it was felling people in the millions. Amelia's ward all of a sudden turned into a ward that was filled with people suffering from the flu as well as pneumonia, and she contracted both, and it turned into something a lot more serious, and that's a sinus condition that she had to face as well. She was hospitalized in the hospital where she worked, and the only thing that could relieve that was an operation on her cheek to kind of alleviate the sinus that she the sinus condition she was suffering from. That never stopped. She continued to have operations and continued to have sores and in flying at altitude, it would be very painful for her because of her sinus condition. And that took place in 1918. It also meant the end of her time in Toronto. She had to find some place and time to convalesce. Muriel had finished her studies and was heading back to the United States. And it was a time for her to join up with Muriel. Both of them lived together in Toronto at the time. The St. Regis Hotel where they lived still has a marker on the ground, even though the hotel has long since disappeared, that marks the spot where Amelia and Muriel had stayed. And a lot of the photographs of the time show Amelia in her cap and gown and her nurse's assistant's outfit at her apartment there. They gave up the apartment, and for Amelia, though, she had tasted for almost a year or so the freedom and independence that she had gained in Toronto. When she went back to the United States, she also knew what she wanted. For the first time, her path was very clear. It would just take some time in order for it to be realized. She wanted to become a pilot. She wanted to fly.
Now, Amelia makes her return to Canada in 1924. Can you tell everyone why she comes back and what she does while she's there?
Well, throughout the time that she's in the United States, there's a family crisis that's taking place. And for a while, Amelia and her mother and father are back together. And her father, who's had some very difficult times in his jobs, has persuaded the family to come back together and to come to a new home in California, where Amelia takes her flying lessons. And her driving lessons as well. She gets a flying license. She has her own aircraft, and there, the family breakup in 1924 starts to impact all of that. She'd chosen that path that she wanted to be a part of. She'd already been written up in newspapers as a fledgling star in the world of aviation. And now she felt she had to give up her aircraft. Her mother had helped her purchase it and helped her also to dispose of it. So she sold the airplane that she had been flying and building her hours in and bought instead a bright yellow, just like the yellow of her aircraft, a sports car, a speedster, a Kissel speedster, one that was now going to be her way to go across the country to meet up with Muriel, who had now settled in Boston with a new teaching job. Her mother sued for divorce, and there was no chance that this was ever going to be reconciled. So Amelia chose to take her mother back to where Muriel was, and that would be Boston. She had originally thought to fly there. She'd actually plotted this all out, drew up maps, and took all the information down as to flying her mother back to home, but the aircraft was gone now. It was too expensive to run and keep and operate for her, and unless she had made a livelihood with it. But now she had her sports car. And together, the two of them set off on an adventure. Her mother asked her, where are we going? It doesn't look like we're heading towards Boston, because they were heading up north. They were heading up through all kinds of northern adventures in California, Yosemite National Park. And then the next thing her mother knew, they were in Canada. And in those times, the borders between Canada and the United States were pretty fluid. There were lots of border crossings, but there were lots of places where you could just simply drive across. And as Amelia was going from place to place looking for an interesting place to stop, she found the roads were a lot better as she drove up north. And Canadian roads, especially in the area that she was in, Lake Louise and Banff in Alberta, a real touristy area, were well-paved and smooth and easier to drive in compared to the sort of the rugged roads that she had just come through in Montana. So she went along and decided she was going to have another excursion to Calgary, which is nearby. Banff and Calgary are very close by each other, but they were definitely lost to the point that they stopped and asked the nearest stranger for directions and where the main road was, because they were now off the road. And at Calgary, the man on the side of the road was a blanketed Indian and seemed like he was barely able to talk, but he could point to the little stuffed monkey that Amelia had in the back of her car. And, you know, expressing that, you know, he would like that papoose if they would like the answer to where the main road was. Through some sort of sign language, he indicated the papoose. If you could give that to me, I will do what you ask. As soon as he had the papoose in his hands in perfectly good English, he explained that they were off the road by a few miles and to turn this way and that way and they would be back on the road. She thought it was funny and wrote up the humorous incident in her diary. But that's what it was. It was just another adventure to her. And that it took her into Canada was just another sort of offshoot of that adventure. By the time they were finished, they had traveled 7,000 miles. They had broken down many times in far away little towns and eventually made their way to Boston and to meet up with Muriel again. And that's where Amelia's life again takes another path.
And she comes back to Canada again 4 years later in 1928. She seems to be making her return to Canada every so often, but why this time in 1928?
Well, her career path that she had chosen in Boston was a little different. She did have a chance to become, like her sister, a teacher and a social worker. But aviation always stayed in the back of her mind that she wanted to continue on there. She was contacted by the man who built her aircraft. And Bert was interested in selling some new aircraft in the East Coast. So she had the chance now to continue flying. And an aircraft that she could have at any time, because she was now the sales representative for the Kinner Aircraft Company. And along with that, she became part of a board of directors of an airport nearby. And her name became well known in that local community as a budding aviator, an aviatrix. And that came to the attention of Captain Hilton Raley, who was looking for a woman to fly the Atlantic. And he knew of Amelia Earhart. He had known the name. He had seen it in newspapers. He finally contacted her, arranged for an interview, because she was going to take the place of a socialite, Amy Guest, who was going to make that flight but wasn't allowed to by her family, but was willing to pay the cost of the flight, buy the aircraft, hire the pilots, and fly across the Atlantic as the first woman to fly the Atlantic. Charles Lindbergh, in the year before, had made a solo flight. Many flights had gone across the Atlantic, but no woman had ever made the voyage. So it would have been Amelia. And to make it, it had to originate probably from the nearest or the closest land mass in North America to Europe, and that would have been Newfoundland. The aircraft that they flew in, the trimotor that was once owned by Admiral Byrd, made it partway along, but was sort of socked in Halifax, Nova Scotia. And there Amelia sets down with her crew. She's only going to be a passenger. She knows that. She's not being paid. The crew is. She does it for the adventure. She does it for women anywhere. But she has been told to keep this a secret until, you know, it's possible that she's going to make this voyage. There are other women that are trying the very same thing. In fact, one is ahead of her, a streaked ahead of her, and may make that voyage. One is coming from the other side of the world, from Germany. So Amelia is told to be quiet. She's in the aircraft as it comes into Halifax and is hidden away. But newspaper reporters catch on that there's something unusual about this flight. Very few aircraft are coming into a seaport like Halifax at that point. And they track her down and get an interview with the crew. And it reaches the newspapers. And the man behind the entire venture is George Putnam, a publisher, the publisher of Lindbergh's book, Across the Atlantic, We. He wants to see Amelia succeed because he sees, like other people have already noted, Amelia is almost the epitome of Lindbergh. A tall, lean aviator that flew across the Atlantic. He calls her Lady Lindy, and he wants to make sure that she makes it across. Now, when they finally get to Newfoundland, the location that they pick, Trepasi, is by far one of the most difficult ones they could have picked. Their landlocked harbor only gives them a very small channel to get out, and they are at the extreme in terms of the conditions that they have to meet. The aircraft cannot take off with the weight load that it has of fuel unless they start to dump some of the fuel, and that becomes very, very crucial in terms of planning out the voyage across the Atlantic. For 15 days, they are stuck as well with weather conditions that are just unbearable. They also are now having to live off the land. Amelia finds a kind of a set of folks that will look after her. She lives with the people who own a little inn, and there she becomes part of the community. She's arrived with virtually nothing other than the clothes on her back. She has packed a toothbrush and some cold cream and a few handkerchiefs and nothing else. She hasn't even a change of clothing. So she's taken in. She ends up buying a little bit from the little meager amounts of clothing that is available in the town. It's called an outpouring. It's a very, very tiny town. Even today, when I visited it, it hardly has any residents at all that you could see. But her residence where she stayed is still there. And it's amazing that it's being turned into a little tiny museum as well. So in Trapezi, she's looking after a number of different things. She reverts to being the social worker again. She goes to the convent school and starts to teach children and read to them. The family that looks after Richard and Fanny Devereaux make sure that they are keeping the best for her, the best food. Most of the food that the other two crewmen eat is barely palatable, but not for Amelia. She has the best of anything that she could want. Eventually, the flight takes off, and in 20 hours or more, she becomes an international celebrity. The men that actually fly are long forgotten, but Amelia is touted as a worldwide sensation.
And I guess that begs the question now, how did the first transatlantic flight lead to the second one, which would go on to be an even bigger deal, a flight that would be the beginning of Amelia's solo aviatrix legacy?
Well, one of the things that most reporters and news people didn't concentrate on was the fact that what she called herself was just a sack of potatoes. She was baggage. She flew on board as a passenger. She was technically the captain in charge, but not really. She kept a log. She didn't fly. She didn't do any of the flying. She didn't do any of the navigation. So in some ways, she felt that she didn't deserve all the acclaim that was happening because of the flight. So she wanted to go back and actually do the flight herself. And this was about the right time because it was coming up to an anniversary date. It was about the time 5 years before that Lindbergh had flown. And 20 had made it across, 20 flights had made it across the Atlantic by that point. But nobody had flown solo again. Lindbergh was the only one that flew by himself across the Atlantic. It was a dangerous and sometimes some people would call foolhardy venture to try that. So she didn't fly the same route that Lindbergh wanted to, or that she wanted to fly. Lindbergh had flown from New York to Paris. She instead chose to shorten the distance appreciably by flying from Newfoundland. And she chose Harbor Grace. Today, if you go to Harbor Grace, the airport still exists. It's on a plateau on the top of the mountainside. And there, one look down the runway, the grass runway, tells you that one misstep to the back of the area and you're flying into a mountain, a misstep to the sides and you're dropping into the ocean. And many of the flights that originated from Harbor Grace ended in disaster. For Amelia to try that, it was another opportunity to prove that she was one of the leading pilots in the world. And she did manage to do that. To stage two, to Newfoundland, she had a pit stop or a gas break where she had to fuel up because she was flying from Boston and New York and flying on to Newfoundland. So she had an intermediary stop in St. John, New Brunswick, very similar to St. John's, but St. John's, New Brunswick was a place where she could come in and fuel up. And that became another stop along the way in her trek across Canada. There she was recognized as who she was by one of the reporters in town. Stuart Truman got a first-person interview with her at the airport, and in return, rushed over to the newspaper office where he worked as well as a reporter, as the editor of the newspaper, and created a morning edition for the next day, and rushed back to the airport just as Amelia was about to take off with that newspaper to give her that copy that would show the world that she had taken off from Canada on that date, and the newspaper would prove that. She tucked it under her arm and kept it right throughout her time in Harbor Grace. By the time they landed in Harbor Grace, and she had flown actually with her mechanic and her instructor, Bert Belkin, who has a Canadian connection as well, and Ed Gorsi flew with her. She mostly rested through the time until she got to Harbor Grace, and then she would take over. But it had fogged in. And then, miraculously, a little break took place around 7 o'clock in the evening that day on May the 20th. And she was able to use a favorable weather report to take off. So the film that we have for the 5 minutes, there is a combination of all the things that were happening as she came in. She came in, flew into the airport, or at least Bert Balkan flew into the airport for her. She had been resting in the back with her mechanic. They took the time to prep the aircraft, fuel it, and make sure that everything was ready, including some of the repairs that had been made on the airplane just recently. They checked that over. And then she had a chance again to go into the small town, buy some food and some tomato juice to take along with her on the trip. And then also, I guess, meet some of the town officials that all of a sudden started to appear at the airport. And by the time she flew, the newspaper was tucked under her arm, ready to tell the world that she had made the flight on that day. When she lands in Ireland in William Gallagher's farm, the newspaper falls out of the airplane. And days later, Gallagher discovers the newspaper on the ground and looks at the date and the place that it comes from, and somehow mails it back to the newspaper office, back to Stuart Truman, the reporter, who hangs on to it till 1937. And then the news of Amelia's loss in her flight across the Pacific is being recognized all over the world, and it becomes part of a display on Amelia Earhart that ends up in a department store window. Somehow, it goes from hand to hand through five different reporters' hands and eventually ends up in a reporter at a reporter's desk in Vancouver, and that reporter, in his retirement, starts to clear out his desk and recognizes that it's an important artifact, sends it to the museum in Ottawa, our Canadian National Museum, much like the Smithsonian, and there it is to this day. And when I contacted the curator about the newspaper, he, for the first time, noticed that she had signed very faintly her name on the newspaper, and that hadn't been, you know, evident before. So that newspaper has a story almost of its own. Amelia comes back that year in December of 1932, back to Canada again. She delivers a series of speeches in Toronto and lecturing at the University Women's Club and also the Canadian Club. There's at least a record of one of those talks. She talks to people that, you know, are impressed by her flying, but she wants to tell them how much she's impressed by Toronto itself. It was a time of romance, she felt, for herself. It was a time when she was getting her path in life chosen for her. She spoke at length about her experiences, and she attributed her career in the air to Toronto. She said, I think the aviation bug entered my system at that time, and it probably has never left. Now, in her talk, she explained some of the, you know, the things that she saw for the future in transportation and aviation being a real part of that. She had been married by this time, and she'd married George Putnam, and his work took him from New York to Los Angeles, and for him to travel that distance constantly by train was difficult. He often flew with her. She just sort of packed him up, put on some coveralls on him, and off they would go. Because if she had an engagement, a speaking engagement, or was doing something with some of the other interests that she had, and they could include anything from clothing to advertising, cigarettes of all things, he would come along. And aviation became very commonplace for that, for them and their family, more so than even their automobiles. She also talked a lot about what her life had been like, and she dispelled some of the rumors that she had killed a cow in Ireland. She had actually been careful enough to land without disturbing the pasture and its cows. So Amelia did come back one more time to Canada.
And that's where it gets even more interesting. Let's get into that final contact that Amelia had with Canada and why it may be the most unique of all of her Canadian history.
Well, a number of listeners had been attuned to their ham radio sets on her last flight in 1937. And July the 2nd, she disappears off the radio waves, but not for everyone. So some record had been made across the world of radio messages, and one of them had been picked up on July the 5th in Toronto. Mrs. Ernest Crabb wrote down the following messages. Are you all right? Hold this line. Do you think they got our SOS? And she thought that came from Amelia. It's not clear, and one of the historians that I've checked with, Mike Campbell, has said that that's probably one of the hoax messages that were coming across the airwaves at that time. We're not sure. Was it her last real contact with Canada? And it came in Toronto again.
Now, let's talk about legacy, and I want to make this a specific two-part question for you as opposed to a general one. I wonder if you can expand and then summarize what her Canadian legacy is, and then discuss what her general worldwide impact is. But first, how do Canadians feel about Amelia Earhart, and what is her legacy there?
You know, it's almost a generational thing today to talk to people about Amelia Earhart. Most people know of her mainly because of the long-standing search through the Pacific for some sort of solution or answer to her disappearance. So they know her more for her disappearance than what she had done. Every time I've spoken to people about this story in Canada, that's what their recollection is. It's the story of those finds that sometimes were turned out not to be really important at all. And it sort of has made a mystique out of the story of Amelia. It's become the story of a disappearance rather than the story of a very remarkable woman and a very remarkable person that had made so much of an impact. Recently, I did a random search through our biggest bookseller in our country. 69 books appear under the name or title or subject area of Amelia Earhart. There are so many different accounts that need to be told, and from so many different angles, from her family, from two books written by Muriel, from her children. She inherited a family that the Putnams dearly loved, and she loved as well. So she became the stepmother that everyone wanted stories from every aspect, from her being a fashion icon, from her being a woman's advocate, from different sources, from Purdue University, where a lot of her account has been kept in various forms, from photographs to other memorabilia and artifacts. It remains to this day. Every place that I have visited, there is some record of her. In Harbor Grace, the Conception Bay Museum has some items that she touched, and that's all it amounted to in the end, because she didn't spend a lot of time there. At St. John's, New Brunswick, she was only there for what one reporter said was a pit stop and a peace stop. And yet there's a painting made of her travel to this little tiny airport. There's a plaque there. I visited the locations in Canada that the film Amelia was shot at, and everywhere the aircraft that were used still exist. The friendship now is in a museum called the Bush Plane Heritage Museum. The Vega ends up in San Diego's Air and Space Museum that was used. The Lockheed Electra 12 is in Niagara Falls. Everyone who ever met her remembered something about her. We have more photographs of her at the time she was in Toronto than most people would ever have imagined. Anyone that ever saw her or contacted her kept a bit of that memory alive. I have some of the postcards that she was going to sell at the end of her flight. They were all stamped ahead of time with her name. Every time I show those postcards to anybody, they're amazed that, you know, she had left that indelible record even to this day. Since that time, I've worked with a number of people, from archaeologists to other historians, to try to piece together what I think may have happened. And the closer I get to it, the farther away I am. I've flown on a Lockheed Electra. I've been involved with pilots who still fly one of the last Lockheed Electras in Canada. It's here in our city. I've matched up some of the parts of an archaeological dig that took place in the South Pacific in an atoll which is uninhabited. Amelia Atoll, no one lives there to this day, yet we are still finding aircraft pieces in that location. Pieces that are from an American aircraft. They're not Japanese. They're not from some other part of the world. They're from Amelia Atoll. So the story still rings on and rings true. What was she? She was something that everyone saw in a different way. The girls that she met at school still recall to their dying day what she meant to them. She was fun. She was adventure. She was exploring. She was doing things that they loved. The next thing you knew, she was hopping on stilts that she made and rolling down the side of the building that kind of resembled a roller coaster that her uncle built. She was on a pogo stick. She was fun. She was at the beach. She was a tennis star. She rode horses like no one could believe. And she could fly. Maybe, you know, some of the accounts that say that she wasn't the best flyer are possibly true, but she could fly. And that changed the world for a lot of people. She brought aviation to a meaningful level to many, many people. Pictures of her with 100,000 people around her show just what impact she still made then, and probably still makes even to this day. And I think it's a shame that all we know of her is that she's lost somewhere in time and space.
If I could ask you to describe Amelia Earhart in a single word, what word would you pick?
Bold.
It's a good word, and it's appropriate. This has been a great conversation, and I think it's one of those that will open the eyes of a lot of listeners that have maybe not heard most of what's been covered tonight. So, Bill, thank you for spending a little time with me tonight to discuss Amelia Earhart's Canadian connection and legacy. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, Chris. It's been a pleasure on my end as well.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Chasing Earhart podcast, part of our Legacy Retrospective series. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Come back to ChasingEarhart.com each week for another new podcast. While at ChasingEarhart.com, visit our archives and our blog to hear all of the past episodes and interviews with guests such as Brad Meltzer, Tom Vinson, Candace Fleming, Jessica Cox, Abigail Harrison, and Shasta Ways. You can also hear interviews with representatives of all of the relevant hypotheses regarding the disappearance of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, such as Tom King, Dick Spink, Gary LaPook, Rick Gillespie, Andy Sherrill, and more. Also at our site, you can find hundreds more posts, project updates, and much more information regarding the life and disappearance of Amelia Earhart. The Chasing Earhart podcast is a show without any sponsors or ads. We rely on support from listeners like you to keep the Chasing Earhart project operating. You can donate to the show, and as our thank you, receive bonus podcasts, merchandise, and advanced opportunities for Chasing Earhart events. Find a full list of available shows and rewards at patreon.com/chasingearhart. You can also follow the project on social media, where our team posts all of our shows, news, and project information, and that hashtag is @ChasingEarhart. The Chasing Earhart podcast is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by Tom Myers. Podcast music is provided by Dane Schmidt, and narration is done by Chris Williamson. The opinions on Chasing Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. Chris Evan Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All movie clips and audio used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of historical education, and no infringement is intended. The Chasing Earhart podcast is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. The Chasing Earhart podcast is a Chris Evan Films production. Copyright 2018. All rights reserved.